Let's open up our time in prayer this evening. Thank you, Father, for tonight and just for our opportunity to come and gather and continue to think through this topic of what your word says about immigration. Help us to think wisely tonight about how to apply that to ourselves individually and even think about what it means for nations like ours. God, there's a lot of complex issues in this, and so we just ask that you give us grace and help us to think carefully. Give us grace where members of a church like ours might disagree on application. May our hope ultimately be in the coming kingdom of your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, and not upon the kingdoms of this earth. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, of course, we're talking about the subject of immigration and the Bible. Last week, we spent our time together introducing the topic and then looking at four key terms in the Pentateuch for three classes of immigrants. And in introducing this topic, we noted the challenge of it. We noted three interpretive challenges as we thought about this topic. First, there's a wide gap between us and the world of the New Testament, of the Old Testament. That gap is in terms of culture and time. Remember, the Old Testament is primarily the place where we find the Bible talking about the subject of immigration. Second, we noted that the terms used in the Pentateuch for immigration, Pentateuch being the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, those first five books, the terms used there for immigration are not consistently translated in any of the major English versions. And that's where that chart that I handed out last week comes into play, because it helps to kind of begin to sort those out so that you can see the distinctions there. And third, we also noted that the New Testament says nothing directly regarding this issue. So what we did is we focused on four terms for three classes of immigrants used in the Pentateuch. We looked at the Nakri or Nakar or Ben Nakar. These are individuals that Moses uses this term. They had no legal standing in the covenant community. No legal standing. So we saw that last week. There's that kind of individual. Second, there are the Teshub and Sakir. These two are referencing either some sort of resident hireling or hired laborer, depending on the context. So we saw that. There's that kind of immigrant in the Old Testament. These had limited rights in the nation of Israel, including rights to many charitable benefits. And third, there are the Gar, which were individuals who joined the covenant community of Israel. They were granted near full status in the covenant community, with the exception of a few rights. But they had full access to the law courts and all the charitable benefits of society. So Moses uses these four terms. The Teshub and Sakir are referring to the same idea. We looked at that a little bit last week. Four terms to describe three different classes of immigrants within the life of Israel. We also noted a little bit about how someone could become a gar, that person that had the fullest rights in the nation of Israel. We noted that a person had to go through the rite of circumcision and swear allegiance to Israel's God. We saw that implied in several accounts, and we're going to see that demonstrated a little bit more this evening in the book of Ruth. We also last week looked at some translations of these terms that would be helpful across the Old Testament. The best translation for gar is probably something like resident alien. A secure, we noted, had a couple of different translations depending on the context. When it's used with the word teshub, it's probably best translated as resident hireling. When it occurs without teshub, it's probably best translated as a hired worker. We noted that this word secure could refer to someone who is a foreigner who is now here working, a resident hireling. Some of you probably rightly pointed out it's akin to something like a green card or a temporary work visa. Secure alone just refers to a hired worker. An Israelite citizen, as we might think of it, could be a hired worker. And then finally, we looked at the Nokri, Nakar, Ben Nakar. These are foreigners, probably a good translation. They're just in general foreigner. A foreigner could be viewed negatively or positively or indifferently along the way. Now, we left off thinking about questions about how to apply this to today. We noted that when we think about what Moses instructs, this is, of course, God through Moses instructs for the people of Israel, when we think about those three different classes of immigrants, that some really hard questions occur as we try to think about how to apply that to our context today. There are some differences between us and Israel that we noted about. One would be something like the governing structure. Israel was under a theocracy, while America is a constitutional republic. We also noted that when someone became a gar, they swore allegiance, that resident alien, they swore allegiance to Israel's God. We don't have that kind of test for our nation. And by the way, we don't want to either. Third, one could not become part of Israel as a resident alien merely for economic reasons. Many people come to the United States for merely economic reason. In fact, I suspect, as most of us are the descendants of immigrants, that most of our forefathers came here for economic reasons. I mean, some of you maybe, you know, can tie your history back to, you know, the Mayflower. I mean, you came for religious reasons, but most people have come here for economic reasons. You couldn't do that in Israel at all. Also in Israel, a resident alien could not become part of government, whereas in America, an immigrant can, except he or she cannot become president. Okay, so there's some differences there when we think about the world of the Old Testament. That would be there, the old world that you see pictured there, and our world today. And it makes it hard for us to think about how we could cross the bridge to bring principles from the Old Testament to us today. Now, that's kind of where we left off last week. That's a summary of what we talked about. But let me just give kind of two initial takeaways from what we have looked at last week. One thing I should have done last week is to make sure that something was a little more clear. Why did we do that long, boring, cry your eyes out word study? Okay, and I get that was long and it was tedious as we worked our way through that. I sort of alluded to it, but I didn't make it entirely clear. In fact, one of my kids asked me about it afterwards. They said they kind of followed it, but what was the point? And I assure you, my point was not to bore you to tears, although some of you probably felt that way. There are two huge takeaways from that extended word study, and they're especially important today as it relates to the subject of legal versus illegal immigration. The first is that some people point to the Old Testament and say, in essence, anybody here in our country should be treated as a citizen. Now, just for those of you here last week, you're thinking through those three different classes. Based upon what we saw in the Old Testament, is that a legitimate application of the Old Testament? No. The Old Testament itself didn't have that as a standard, okay? The people of God in Israel did not have that, okay? Now that's really actually important because there are a number of people that want to use verses I think they're hijacking out of context and to try to make Christians feel guilty about their views about immigration that I think are inappropriately used. Now, of course, we as a nation could choose to do this. There's nothing preventing us or any other nation to saying anybody who comes in our borders, we're going to accept them and let them become citizens. A nation could choose to do that, but it's an illegitimate application of the Old Testament to say that anybody here, we as Christians need to treat them as citizens. You can't use all those resident alien passages to prove how we ought to treat illegal aliens here, or for that matter, for how we ought to treat temporary people who are here for guest visas. That's just not the same. So it's an illegitimate application of that. And that's important because many Christians, as I mentioned, have in essence made this argument, and they try to guilt people into thinking that we either as a nation ought to think this way or we as individuals ought to think this way. So they'll quote, and I'm going to refer to this, these two verses quite a bit here tonight. They'll quote this text from Leviticus 19:33-34. It says, "When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." So the argument that they'll make is we should treat all people this way who come across our borders. But they might also use this to guilt individual Christians as to what they should do. And so this doesn't work, though, because this word that's used in Leviticus 19 for a stranger, it's that word gar. It's that word for resident alien. That we're talking about someone in this case who has come and identified with Israel's God and sworn allegiance to Israel's God. It's not just anybody who came into the border, across the border of Israel. So that's an illegitimate use of this text. The text is really clear in the Old Testament that not all immigrants in the Old Testament are seen as the same. Now, we need to make something very, very clear. There's nothing that says that we as a nation should equate Israel's threefold division as ours. In other words, we're not required to say this is what Israel did, therefore the United States, or for that matter, Zimbabwe should do. There's nothing that requires us to do so. I'm not suggesting that we should. I'm simply pointing out that you can't take a verse or these verses like this in Leviticus and say, see, this is what we should do with people who come across our borders. That's an illegitimate use of this text. Now, my guess, and more than a guess because I know most of you personally, is that most of you are probably something of conservatives politically, which is, historically, we're in Trump territory, okay? I know that. I think in 2020, nearly 70% of our county voted for Donald Trump. That's the definition of conservative, territory. And so there might be a temptation for us to immediately say, yes, I like that. See, now I can say, you can't use those texts to say that we should accept everybody coming across our border, whether from the south, the northeast, or the west, all right? Just because we see and we suspect a pile of problems because of the flood of illegal immigrants into our country doesn't mean that this is the end of the story. Pointing out the threefold division seems attractive to conservatives politically. However, as I mentioned, this is not the whole story. The second huge takeaway is that some Christians, and let me be clear, I'm not accusing anybody in this room of this, okay? But some Christians seem to have an almost anti-immigration spirit. And the threefold division that Moses articulates in the Old Testament, if you're going to apply it to us today, doesn't let you do that. Doesn't let you do that. So I just want to point out to you how much God in the Old Testament, you look at those verses in the chart that I gave, how much God cares about the gar, the resident alien, and the secure, the resident hireling. You read through these verses and you see the abundance of care for these individuals. Now, here's what that means. If you're going to argue on the one hand and say, aha, see the threefold division in the Old Testament teaches me that it's okay that we would have such a class as illegal immigrants in our country or for anywhere else, then we also need to accept that if you're going to use that text, those texts, you're going to use them there, then you need to use those texts equally across the board. So let's put up Leviticus 19:33-34 again and note what this says. When a stranger sojourns with you, when this resident alien comes to you, they stay in the land. This is someone who's sworn allegiance to Israel's God. You shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns you with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So here we have the second reason why this threefold division of understanding the classes of immigrants in the Old Testament is important. If it says to us on the one hand that not all immigrants are created equal, and we want to apply that to either the nation or to ourselves, what do we do with this command to immigrants who are here legally? What does this say that our attitude ought to be towards them? All right? So let's just look at what it says there. The resident alien should not be treated wrongly. You shall treat the resident alien as the native. That's what it says. Okay, so in other words, if we're going to say, let's apply that division, threefold division, take the whole package then. You can't just split that out. You have to treat people who come here legally just as you would treat any other citizen, if you want to make that, cross that bridge into our world today. What does that mean, for instance, for pay? That actually becomes a really uncomfortable subject if you actually do a deep dive on the history of how immigrants have been paid in our country over the last 150 years, including legal ones. Okay? So if we're going to take that threefold division and say, yes, there is such a thing as illegal immigrants, what about how we treat ones who come here legally? And it is uncomfortable. All you got to do is start just learning, how do we treat the Chinese when they came over here in the late 1800s and early 1900s? Including also a number of Hispanics in the mid-1900s as well, who did come here legally. You start reading about that, and it's going to go, not make you feel so good. Okay? Just telling you that, right? You can do that on your own time. How about this? You shall love him as yourself. Let's just ask in general, is that the attitude of most people in our country who are already here when they see other people who are not from here who come here legally? Is that their immediate response? For some people, I think the answer is yes. But my experience says for other people, not so much. And that's not just now, by the way. You all know the history of the Irish in New York City, you know? How were they treated? Anybody here Irish, by the way? Yeah.
A wee bit.
Oh, a wee bit? All right. All right. Right. You do a history, a study of a history of that, and you go, not so good there. I mean, for that matter, my great-grandfather and my great-grandmother, one was a Swede and the other was a Norwegian. And my understanding is that my great-grandmother, who was a Norwegian, her Swedish in-laws would not speak to her until the day she died. All right? Even though they were both here legally. All right? And that went both ways, all right? So we can't just pick on the Swedes or the Norwegians. So this is a challenge for us as we think about this. In other words, if you're going to say, yes, I like that division aspect of different kind of immigrants, then you have to think through this. Now, it's interesting that these commands are grounded in two realities. And I think that these ought to give us some thoughts for how we should apply this for us today. The first is, Moses says, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. That's an interesting thing to consider, because when Moses wrote this command, all of the people who were listening to it were people who had, by and large, been physically in the land of Egypt. But this was not just for them. This idea was passed down from generation to generation among the people of Israel. They were always to remember that they, as a people, came from a foreign country. And when they were in that foreign country, Egypt, some of their time there, they were treated well. Think of Joseph and his brothers. Did Pharaoh treat them well as resident aliens? For sure. But then think about the Pharaoh who arose who did not know the Lord and did not know Joseph. How did he treat them? He treated them horribly. And they were always to remember that as a people, that they had gone through this experience as a people, both positively and negatively, and it ought to motivate them to treat the resident alien who came among them well, very well. And this was passed down throughout the time of, or throughout the generations of Israel. So consider Ezekiel 22, verse 29, which I'm going to put up on the board there, but you're welcome to, in a second, you're welcome to turn there if you like. If you read in Ezekiel, Ezekiel is going through an absolute denunciation of Israel for her failure to obey the commands of the covenant. If you read through Ezekiel 22, you have all sorts of perversities that are mentioned about her. Bloodshed, false prophets, sexual deviancies, and so on. But it's interesting as you read through, as Ezekiel just goes and pounds Israel for its failure to fulfill the covenant, he adds this thing as the last of the indictments against Israel. He closes with this. The people of the land have practiced extortion and committed robbery. They have oppressed the poor and needy and have extorted from the sojourner without justice. Sojourner is that word gar, resident alien. In other words, the thing that Ezekiel closes with in his condemnation of Israel was that they took advantage of people who did not or were not able to defend themselves. That's the definition. And by the way, isn't that true almost always of every foreigner in a land? So you see this everywhere. So Casey and I, you know, of course, we were in Liberia last year. When we went back in November and December to get the girls and actually bring them home, we had to go through some medical testing, all right, for the girls to get them here. They had to go through a TB test and pass a basic physical and things like that in order to bring them to the United States. That's fine. But along the way, when we went to the medical facility, they picked us out as we're walking. And medical facility is a really generous term, by the way. I'll just say that. It's like a hole-in-the-wall place that you go up this dank staircase, and you got a bunch of rooms that are cement where the paint's falling off the wall, and doesn't make you feel comfortable. But they picked us out right away. Nobody else had to do this, but they saw us and they said, "You need to wear masks because of COVID," right? And they charged us for little paper masks $1 a piece, right? Which for us, you know, $1 is $1, whatever. But for them, that was a gold mine. Now, what were they doing at that point? They're doing this. This is not unique to our culture or anywhere else. It's also why we had to pay a series of expediting fees to get paperwork done. It's also known as a bribe. And they did that because we're foreigners and they knew there was nothing we could do about it. All right? And we're not supposed to pay them, but sometimes because it was a transition in government, we had to do that. Is that or we don't bring them home? You know? Well, what are they doing? I'm in a foreign land. I have no power, no legal rights, no authority there whatsoever, and people were ready and willing to take advantage of us. Now, for them, I'm sure they justified it. You know, they're rich, they're white, they're Americans, they have the money. I'm definitely white, definitely American, definitely not rich. All right, so that third category doesn't fit that so much. All right, so this is nothing new. This is nothing new. But Israel, in particular, was denounced for their failure to follow the Lord. Okay, so they forgot at times that they had been strangers in the land of Egypt. Remember, the commands here in Leviticus 19 we're looking at, they're grounded in two realities. First, you're strangers in the land of Egypt. Second, he says, "I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord your God." God grounds the fair treatment of the resident alien with the fact that God is their God. It is rooted in the character of God as Lord and Master. In fact, if you look in Leviticus 19, the seriousness of this starts back in Leviticus 19 and verse 2 when it says, "Speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" So the reason why they were to treat the resident alien with dignity and justice and failure was rooted in the very character of God. What Leviticus 19 does is to unpack what holiness looked like in the life of Israel. Because God was their God and he's a holy God, they should emulate that in everything they do. In many ways, Leviticus 19 is Israel's sanctification. Here's what it looks like to be dedicated to the Lord your God. And one of the things that it looked like was to be a person who loved the resident alien as yourself. That was significant for God, for the people of Israel. Now, this is also a very important thing to consider, because if we want to apply the idea of a threefold division of immigrants and say, look, we don't have to treat illegals as natives, and we base that off of the threefold division, what does it say about how we view legal immigrants? It's hard for me to say that we can pick and choose and say, I like what the law says about this, but I don't necessarily like what the law says about that. The law is a whole. You take it or leave it as a whole. So if you like the idea of saying there is such a thing as a foreigner who has no legal standing here, and you base it off the Old Testament, you also have to say, well, I should like what Leviticus 19 says about my attitude towards immigrants who are here. Now, I would say that most of us, myself included, that we agree with Leviticus 19 in principle. Right? Even though we know that the law isn't directly for us today, there are principles that reveal something about God, and there's something about the way God's people are to behave that are applicable for us today, including, I think, Leviticus 19, 33, and 34. And so we would say, yes, I think as someone who follows God, we would want to treat someone who came from another country, and they'll say they did it by the rules, they're here legally, that we would want to treat them fairly. And that, yes, we should love them as anyone else who is already here. I think in principle, that is easy to say. Except for, what about people that look like that? Just my experience among conservatives says, if I ask them, do you love them? They're here legally in the same way as a native born. Is that your natural, immediate inclination? I'm just going to confess that for me, for much of my life, the answer was no. That's not how I thought. Or how about these people? We have tons of them here in Minnesota, the Hmong people. And you know what? You go down the road here, they've set up a Buddhist garden. And you go down the road that way, they have a Buddhist temple. Man, that gets awkward, doesn't it? Like, how do we begin to process that? So in other words, if we take the division, that threefold division, say, yes, like that, clear cut, we don't have to treat everybody coming across our borders, south, north, east, west, the same. But then we have to go, what do we do with the other parts there? And that's difficult. That's difficult for us. Now, how do we go forward from here? Well, I'd like us to look at another passage of Scripture that helps us, I think, to start providing a pathway forward for us to think about. And it gets to the question of how was Israel to treat the gar, that's that resident alien, and secure the resident hireling. And it comes in the example of Ruth. You're welcome to turn there in your Bibles if you like. I'm also going to put some of the verses up on the screen as well. Everything I have tonight is in the ESV. So if you see some differences there in translation, that's where that's coming from. Now, while you're turning there to Ruth, or just thinking about the book of Ruth, let's consider Ruth as a test case for how Leviticus 19, 33, and 34 was applied by the man Boaz. Now, I put this up already on the board already, but let's remind ourselves of it again. When a stranger sojourns, when a gar, when a resident alien comes and becomes a resident alien with you in your land, you shall do him no wrong. You shall treat this resident alien who is resident alien-ing with you as the native among you. You shall love him as yourself, for you were resident aliens. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Okay? So let's think about that verse, which would have been in the background of somebody like Boaz, and think about how he applied that in his day. Now, as we're thinking about this, we should start by reminding ourselves about the basic structure of the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth begins in verse 1 by describing the conditions that led Ruth's eventual father-in-law, Elimelech, and his two sons from leaving the land of Israel and settling in the land of Moab. Notice it. It says, "In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem and Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." Word sojourn there, verb form for gar. He became a resident alien in Moab. All right. Now, the place that they went to, Moab, is not insignificant. I'm going to grab a laser pointer here in a second if I need it to point out some words. I forgot to bring this up earlier to me. So the place that they go to in Moab, that's not insignificant here. That is extremely significant. It occurs in the very first verse of the book of Ruth. And if you were reading this in Israel's day, there would be all sorts of things going off in your mind. What in the world? Okay? And the reason for that is that Moab was a wretched country that was the enemy of Israel. All right? They hated each other. They had hated each other for a long, long time. Moab engaged in wicked practices sexually and in their idol worship. Of course, you remember that Balaam, the king of Moab, tried to convince Balaam to curse Israel when they were coming out of Egypt. This was a feud that had gone on for quite a few centuries at this point. They're not well liked between each other. So the people of Israel did not look upon Moab kindly. Well, there in Moab, the sons married two girls, Orpah and Ruth. They lived there, according to verse 4, about 10 years. All three of the men died, and the women were left destitute. Of course, you remember the account that Naomi, that would be Ruth's mother-in-law, was extremely bitter. And she tries to get the two daughters-in-law to stay while she goes back to Israel to find some semblance of a life after her husband and two son-in-laws have died. Now, Orpah, she leaves and she goes back to her home country of Moab, but Ruth will not. And you read in chapter 1, after some arguing back and forth, Ruth makes this incredibly powerful statement in Ruth chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. She says to Naomi, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." This is, by the way, one of those powerful statements in the Old Testament about someone who swears allegiance to Israel's God, who is not from Israel. This is actually in covenant language form. The ending formula when it says, "May the Lord do so to me," is the kind of things you would find in a formal oath or covenant statement. And she is swearing allegiance not just to Naomi, but to the God of Israel. When you see the Lord, L-O-R-D in all caps, we're talking about Yahweh here. She is saying, "I am committed to being a woman, as a woman, a part of the people of Israel." It's an incredibly powerful statement. Now from here, of course, we have one of the greatest love stories ever told. But before we get to that love story, we need to remember the position that Ruth was in at this point. The Old Testament describes a woman such as Ruth as an almanah widow. That's a word that's translated as widow often, but it has a distinct idea in the Old Testament law. It's a widow with no son, and as a widow with no son in that culture, and not just in Israel's culture, in all the surrounding cultures, the widow with no son would have had no legal representation from her husband's family unless someone took the role upon himself. Now, this creates a real problem for Ruth because not only is her husband dead and gone, but also her father-in-law, the only one who would have had the responsibility to represent her well for legal rights, he is now dead and gone as well. There's nobody left to take care of her and to represent her cause. Now, according to the Old Testament law, If a man died and left a widow, his nearest brother should marry her and raise up a family through her. Now, for us today, that's just creepy weird, okay? And I get that. But actually, when it comes to the Old Testament context, this was actually extremely helpful for a widow because she would have been destitute. This would guarantee that someone would actually take care of her. And furthermore, in the Israelite covenant community, it would also provide a way for her land that came down through her husband to be secured for her and also her descendants. But of course, Naomi doesn't have another son. In fact, remember that in chapter 1? She says, look, if I had sons that you could marry, you know, you could have one. But I don't, and I'm old, and it's not going to happen. That's her basic argument in chapter 1. By the way, that's helpful to understand. Naomi was bitter, but she wasn't totally wrong in encouraging the girls to go back to Moab, because there wasn't actually a way for them to easily be married and have a secure future in Israel. I think she lacked faith there. You see a lot of conflict in Naomi's life, but she is in some sense not totally disregarding them by trying to send them back. But of course, Naomi, she doesn't have a son. There's no brother-in-law, and thus there is a legal loophole here for Ruth. And she would not have been desirable for someone in marriage. There's no dowry attached to her, as Naomi is poor. A man who married her would raise up family for her land and not his own. So as one commentator has put it, willingly marrying into Naomi's family seemed to be financial suicide. You would secure benefits for Ruth and her descendants, but not for your own family. Thus the story continues. Ruth happens upon Boaz's field. Boaz notices her and shows kindness to her. But remember that Ruth is shocked that Boaz would show kindness to her. You remember this in Ruth chapter 2 and verse 10? It says, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? The word foreigner is that word nakar that we talked about last week. I don't have any legal rights here. I don't have any legal claims here, she was saying. At least that's what she thought. In her mind, she did not have any rights to the land or to be blessed. And of course, Boaz did bless her. Remember, he said, you know, you can glean in the field. And then, of course, he told his harvesters, you know, leave, you know, piles of grain for her so she can pick up real easily. I mean, he really did bless her. He took care of her. In her mind, that shouldn't have happened. She was a nakar. She didn't have a right. That no creed nakar kind of person. She didn't have a right in this land. But watch Boaz's response in verses 11 and 12. But Boaz answered her and said, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord, Yahweh, repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So Boaz was treating her well, not simply because he thought she was pretty, or maybe hoped that maybe she would marry him. In fact, I would say we don't have time to do a deep dive in this, but actually, Boaz really did not have much of a financial interest here at all. And even furthermore, she would have been significantly younger than him. And even in Israel's day, that wasn't exactly viewed with kindness, per se. Boaz was treating her well because he believed what God had said. This woman came looking for protection under Israel's God. And so he saw that and said, I'm going to make sure that she's taken care of. As such, she was worthy of the protection that God had given such people under the law. Remember again, Leviticus 19:33 through 34, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, do not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns you as the native among you. You shall love him as yourself. Boaz was doing exactly what the Old Testament covenant law commanded. Of course, now you remember the account, right? And then eventually Naomi starts to get involved in here and goes, aha, there's a family connection here. This could actually work out in all of our favor. Maybe he'd be interested in marrying you. Let's kind of push this thing along. I'll play ultimate matchmaker and send you down to the threshing floor and you can lay at his feet overnight. And that'll be awkward for everybody and it'll force him to make a decision, okay? That's really what happened there at that point, okay? And so she does that. And she goes to the threshing floor. Boaz is willing right away to act as the kinsman redeemer and raise up for her a family through her. But he can't do that right away because remember that there was someone who was a closer relative that would have the rights potentially to do this before him. So what Boaz does is he goes and he summons this closer relative who's never named in the text. And he brings him to the gate of the city before the other elders of the city. And he kind of sets this guy up. He says this in Ruth 4, verses 3 through 4. He says to the Redeemer, Naomi, who's come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. Pause there and just note that she could do this because she had no sons who could inherit the land. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I'll redeem it. Now here's what that meant for him. This provided a tremendous financial advantage. You can't just in Israel buy anybody's land. You remember that after every 50 years, you had to give it back to the family tree, the parcel of land that you bought? This was a piece of land that he would have had to right to possess in perpetuity for all of his descendants. And so he's like, yeah, she's selling. I'm buying. I can get this land, pass it on to my sons, and this will be great for all of us. It seemed like a great thing to do. But then Boaz points to the man what he would also have to do in what's called a levirate marriage. That's where one of the sons would marry the widow. Then Boaz said, the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Then the Redeemer said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Now, there's been a lot of speculation as to why this man refused the redemption, but the most likely reason, it was going to cost him a lot, and he was not going to gain anything financially for himself. You can think of it this way. In order for him to be able to gain the property, he would have to pay for it. Naomi needs one of her close relatives to use his resources so that her field would not be lost. A sum of money would be agreed upon. He would purchase the land out of his own pocketbook. Upon Naomi's death, he would receive the land fully and add it to his land holding. However, the land would be passed down through Ruth's progeny and not his own. And thus he would have to pay money out of his own pocket to get the land temporarily, and he would never actually be able to possess it for his children and his children's children. If he bought the land, the money would go to Naomi. She would get to use that money in her old age. He would appear generous and provided for. That would be a great business decision in one sense, but it also would have cheated Ruth out of what she had at least potentially some right to. The catch, of course, was that the nearer redeemer would have to marry Ruth. But even this, actually, in the Old Testament law, is kind of fuzzy. All right? It's really uncertain, based upon the law of Moses, whether this man had to marry Ruth or not. And the reason for that is the Old Testament law talks specifically about brothers marrying the widow. It doesn't talk about extended family beyond. Boaz was really shrewd in what he's doing here because he presented this issue in front of all the men of the city, the leading men of the city. And how is it going to look for this guy if he says, look, I have the right to buy this property and I can possess it for my own, and the law doesn't explicitly say that I have to marry her. I can take it for myself. How's that going to look in the community, small city of Bethlehem, where everybody seems to already have loved Ruth? She was a hard worker. Everybody noticed that. And this guy was going to possess the land but not actually marry her. Boaz, he's pulling some legal strings here about as thin as they possibly can go, and he's using public pressure to make sure that Ruth is actually cared for. That's the rub of this story. And so he says, I can't redeem it for myself lest I ruin my inheritance. I don't want to marry her, okay? Now Boaz, I think, functioned here perfectly according to the heart of the Old Testament law for a sojourner, for a resident alien. It's actually quite fascinating. The law of the Old Testament did not actually have a specific command to deal with this kind of situation, but Boaz was looking beyond the letter of the law to the heart of what the law demanded and the justice of the law. Think of this in Deuteronomy 10, 17 through 19. For the Lord your God is a God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, the awesome God, who is not partial. He doesn't take a bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless. He executes justice for the widow. He loves the sojourner, the gar, the resident alien, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, because you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Boaz had that kind of heart for her. He was not interested in the mere letter of the law, but rather what the law was actually about. And what it was about was protecting the poor and the needy, the fatherless and the widows. And he wasn't about to let a potential legal loophole actually hurt this individual. So Boaz put pressure, social pressure, on this other kinsman redeemer and provided a better alternative for her. Boaz functions as the ideal advocate for Ruth. First, he acted solely for the benefit of Ruth and Naomi. He didn't say, what can I get for myself? Now, of course, some people would argue, well, he got a young wife. Yes, he did. But also, that was really risky in that society, because she was a Moabitess, right? So it's not, you know, there's a lot to this, all right? Questions about that. And furthermore, if you read the account of Ruth, the statements that Boaz makes about Ruth is never about because she's young and attractive. It's actually because she committed to Israel's God, and he wanted to fulfill the ideal of what God had for these people. So it doesn't seem to be that. He seems to be actually benefiting Ruth and Naomi here. And second, he also forced action by making this issue public. Professor of mine, Preston Mays, he comments on this passage this way. He says this, quote, injustices are often perpetuated simply because nobody takes the initiative to address them. But at least as frequently, injustices are perpetuated because the person taking the initiative places all the responsibility for doing so on somebody else. Boaz's actions avoided both problems, assuring that Naomi and Ruth would not suffer because nobody attempted to help them. If the nearer redeemer would marry Ruth, then Boaz was willing to accept the result. But if the nearer redeemer was unwilling to do so, Boaz made himself the backup plan. So he wasn't going to let an injustice happen to this vulnerable widow. So when you compare that to the nearer redeemer, where was the nearer redeemer's heart? Was it for the poor? Was it for the fatherless? Was it for the widow? What's that? It wasn't for him, get her out of here, right? That's not my problem. He really was for himself. So I think that actually is an important text, because it shows that the heart of God was for these people, and they really, the Israelites, were to really bend over backward to fulfill God's model of justice for them. Now, very quickly, I mentioned this last week, we do need to ask the question, what about the New Testament and immigration? And then we'll get to some modern-day application, give some broad suggestions. As I mentioned last week, there are no direct commands about how nations or individuals should seek to deal with immigrants in the New Testament. There are two texts that do have potentially some implication for these things. The first text is from Acts 17:26, which says, "And he, God, made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place." So Acts 17:26 comes into play because if someone says, you know, we really shouldn't have borders at all, and you will hear some, I think, extreme Christians saying things like that, it doesn't fly. I mean, Paul says very clearly that nations do have boundaries. However, this passage isn't that much of a help to us because it doesn't deal with how we address people who cross those boundaries. Paul doesn't say anything about that. But that there is a boundary, that nations do have borders, Paul assumed that God, in fact, had those in place in his own mind. A second passage is a long one. I'm not going to deal with this in depth, just to point out this is a text that often is used to try to push people in the New Testament to say that we just ought to do everything we can for anybody who's coming across our borders, no matter where they come from. It occurs in Matthew 25:31-40. I'll read through it. It'll be obvious where people might want to press on this to make us think that we ought to just care for everybody coming across our borders equally. It says, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people from one another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.' Then the righteous will answer him, saying, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger or welcome you, naked and clothed you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?' Then the king will answer them, 'Truly I say to you, you did it to one of the least of these my brothers. You did it to me.'" Now, can this passage be used to tell us something about the treatments of immigrants, no matter what their status? And the answer is not directly, not really at all. For one thing, this text is specifically situated about how people would respond in the tribulation period and how people are to treat the Jewish people during that period. If you study the context, it's very limited application or very limited context to that. But even if you don't hold that view about the tribulation period as I do, almost everyone else would view this as either talking about missionaries or apostles or representatives of Christ, not just anyone generally who is needy. Certainly an application of this could be that we should be generous to those in need, but this has nothing to do with nations, much less individuals and how they deal with immigration. So I just don't want you to have people throw this text in your face and be, you know, made to feel guilty about it. That's not what this passage is about. Other than that, quite frankly, there's nothing directly more that the New Testament talks about immigration. You could think about the fact that Jesus for a while was a sojourner. Remember when his parents brought him down to Egypt? That's worthy of thinking about, but very little is said about that. You could also consider that we also are pilgrims and exiles according to 1 Peter. There's something worthy to meditate upon that. We don't have time to think through all those deeply, but they're not directly addressing the issue of immigration in general. So, how do we begin to cross the bridge? Okay? We've looked at a lot of information. How do we get from here in the world of the Old Testament, and we've got this huge time, culture, and language barrier? How do we bring some principles into our world today? And how do we apply it today? Okay. The first thing we need to be able to distinguish in our minds is that how we apply this may look differently for what we do as a nation versus what we do as individual Christians. We just need to be able to hold those things differently in our mind. I wish it was as simple as saying, well, if people are here legally, we should do X. If people are here illegally, we should do Y. I wish I could give you like super simple answers to that. But it's not that clear, and it's not that simple. And part of the reason is that when we think nationally, so here we're thinking about what's going on in our world, and specifically I'm thinking about the United States of America. I'm not talking about Canadian immigration or Chinese immigration or South African immigration. When I think about our nation, we have a complicated situation that has been complicated for a long time, which makes application of this very, very difficult. So if you study the issue of immigration, and here I'm just going to focus because this is what's primarily on people's minds today. If you study it, especially as it relates to our southern border, since 1848 and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which ended the Mexican-American War, we've had a terribly inconsistent immigration policy on our southern border. This is over 150 years, actually 170 years. It has been terribly inconsistent. Some, after the settling of the Mexican-American War, came for a short time here expecting to be here temporarily, and they ended up setting up camp here permanently, while others came after 1848 permanently. We did not even have a border patrol until 1924. So for nearly over 75 years after the Mexican-American War, we didn't even patrol the border, right? People kind of crossed and came back and forth as they jolly well pleased. There were attempts to begin to regulate the flow of immigrants. 1924 is an important one, and that's partly because a lot of these issues are often tied economically. Think about what starts to happen in 1924. What are we on the precipice of at that point? The Great Depression. And what's everybody worried about at that point? All the jobs and all the people coming and stealing our jobs. Sound like a familiar argument? 100 years later, is exactly what they're worried about. Thus, the Border Patrol was started. Okay, it was a big deal. There have been attempts to regulate the flow of immigrants into our country. I think, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Bracero Agreement of 1942 allowed for temporary visas for Mexicans for agricultural labor. However, in that treaty, there were not enough visas that were allowed for, and so floods of American businesses brought people across the southern border and used them in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. The Bracero program was shut down in 1965, and instead, new legislation was drafted, the Hart-Celler Immigration Bill, and that set really arbitrary limits to the number of immigrants who could come to this country. It was honestly, obviously, I was not alive in 1965. I look back on this. I can't figure out what the rationale for this was. I think it was just to pacify populist concerns for economic issues. It set as a maximum 20,000 immigrants per country that could come to the United States for every country in the world. Just every country, 20,000. That was it. It also said that no more than 120,000 immigrants could come in total from the entire Western Hemisphere. That included Canada, Latin America, and South America, 1965. Well, guess what? If you're working in states such as Texas or California in the 1960s and you need a lot of labor, how well do you think that they obeyed those laws in the 1960s? They didn't obey them at all. And again, American businesses and capitalists brought in lots of people across the border because it was impossible to actually function that way. And furthermore, people began immediately to think this is rather bizarre. I mean, think about Latin America for a moment. Take Mexico and El Salvador. One is a gigantic nation and one is small. Why would you allot the same number of people coming across the border from both of them? It was a bizarre policy. It was basically busted from day one. It actually was not fully implemented because of the complexity of it until 1968. The numbers for specifically Mexican workers were increased, but it never kept up with demand, so illegal immigration continued to flow. During the Reagan administration, the Immigration Reform and Control Act was passed by Congress in 1986. That law fortified border patrol. It gave greater sanctions for employers who would hire illegal immigrants and provided amnesty for anyone who could prove that they were here before 1982. That was passed during the Reagan administration. 3 million people applied for amnesty under that program after it was passed into law. Now, many employers merely balked at the documentation requirements required by the law. And what it did is, yes, it provided amnesty for some people who were here, but it also spawned a black market for fraudulent papers and encouraged many employers to pay salaries in cash so as to avoid the penalties for hiring illegal workers. Sound like a problem we have today? This is nothing new, okay? And for some of you, when I say this, you'll think how old I am. For some of you, you'll think about hopefully how old I am or how young I am. But in 1986, I was 4 years old, okay? So this has been a problem for my whole life, all right? My whole life, right? In 1990, the Immigration Act was passed, which increased sanctions again for employers and also strengthened Border Patrol. It also made the eligibility of family members who were, like you had one family member here, to bring another one across and make them citizens. It made that process actually more difficult. But it also sought to encourage the entry of people who had more skills from more developed countries. The Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996, among other things, funded increased surveillance along the border, limited access to many federal benefits for undocumented immigrants, and allowed states to reduce public services to immigrants. And basically, since 1996, there has been no significant piece of legislation that has passed Congress to deal with these issues. So we're getting on almost 30 years. There have been a few minor pieces, but nothing that's major. There have been a number of presidential executive orders given, but they have not been congressional acts. And this is hard because you're dealing with political issues at this point, so I'm trying to take my pastor's hat off here for a moment, just comment politically. Presidential executive orders are horrible, horrible ways to deal with laws in our country. That's not the way our government is designed. And both Democrats and Republicans have tried for the last 30 years to address these issues through presidential executive acts. And I'm not trying to comment on any of them, whether they're good or bad, but they haven't worked because our nation is designed to have actually laws passed through Congress and signed by the executive branch. And so it's just created even a greater and greater mess. All right, whether you agree with me on that or not, I don't have any pastoral authority on that issue. But I'm just saying that just in general, that would be my opinion on that. Now, this makes this issue very complicated because I want to be able to say to Christians who are here in this country as citizens to say to Christians who are here illegally alike, just obey the law. But one of the problems that we have is, it's a real question, okay? Is a law if it's not enforced? That's part of the issue, right? It's been said by someone long ago that a law without consequences is nothing more than good advice. And for a long time, we've had laws that we have not bothered to enforce as a nation. Okay? So for me as a Christian pastor to say, obey the law, part of the problem is to say, what law? You know, you can go on the books of every state in the United States and find all sorts of weird, wacky laws that are on the books that nobody obeys still to this day, right? Now, this isn't a weird, wacky law, but it's part of the issue is it's very hard to know how do you apply that to today, right? Now, we might decry that reality, and I do, however great of a problem it is in our nation. The reality is for the better part of 150 years, we haven't actually tried to effectively deal with that as a nation. And we're reaping recent consequences of that. And there are a number of people that are part of this problem. It's government, but it's also businesses who, quite frankly, like cheap labor. That's been part of the history of this whole issue. It's hard to separate all those. And it cuts historically across party aisles. Because you're going to find really bad attempts on both the right and left, I think. That would be just my opinion. So what can we say as we try to cross this bridge for us today? Well, I want to start by just real quickly putting up a chart. This is not original with me. This comes from Preston Mays at Central Seminary. This comes from a paper he delivered at the McDonald Lecture Series in 2021. It's a paper on immigration in the Old Testament. Some of the ideas of this lecture come from him. And he helpfully just developed this. It's really, really simple to talk about, comparison between Israel and us. Top line, of course, we see Israel, we have the question, must accept religion and worldview. If you come to Israel as a resident alien, answer is yes. Of course, we don't have that test in the United States. Middle line, are you under the same laws, wages, and benefits? If you come to Israel, the answer is yes. If you come as a resident alien, in the United States, yes. Do you have the possibility of equal participation in government as a resident alien in Israel? The answer is no. In the United States, the answer is yes, save you can't be president. Those are really just clarifying things. You think about the differences between one and the other, and I found that very, very helpful. I also think it's helpful for us to start thinking about how we might apply this when it comes to national policy. Let's start with that middle line, because there you have a yes and a yes on both sides. The moral idea in the Old Testament was for citizens and immigrants, no matter what their status, to be under the same law and treated as equal in the courts. I'm talking specifically about the Tashib Sakir, and the Gar, the resident aliens and the resident hirelings. Therefore, they should be paid the same kind of wages. I think if we're going to try to apply that today, it is morally wrong to pay immigrants under the table and less than what they would otherwise make, especially to avoid taxes. All right? I just don't see how, if you take the Old Testament and the heart of what God says there seriously and say there's some sort of application for today, I would say that would be the case. All right? Also, the provision that resident aliens were to have access to glean in Israel's fields can be taken as a principle that legal immigrants should be given access to the benefits of living in our country, including government programs. Now, whether or not we should have those programs is another question, but immigration questions should be kept separate from the issue of benefits. That's hard. But you look in the Old Testament, it seemed like somebody who came legally to be a part of Israel were granted all the benefits that that society offered. Okay? Again, taking my pastor hat off, I wish we'd get rid of about 95% of our government programs. Probably most of us agree with that in this room. But be very careful that we don't tie the question of how we treat people coming here legally with the question about government programs. We've got to be able to separate those in our mind at some level. Third, a nation does have rights to secure its borders. The fact that sometimes we've done that inconsistently, or even immorally, whether it's our nation or any other nation, should not be confused for the right for us to do so. We have the absolute right to limit the number of people coming here and can determine what the reasons are that people can come here. I'm not trying to argue for what they should be as a nation, but we do have that right. Now, as to the top line of this chart, the application gets more difficult. Of course, the United States does not have a specific religion, and we do not want one, by the way, for which we must swear, but we do have a document that does govern us. Anyone coming here permanently, I think, should swear allegiance to our Constitution. If we're going to make some sort of application, there is a swearing of allegiance for Israel. We don't have a religious test, but we ought to have that kind of test. So I see no problems at all with having people being able to pass citizenship tests and so on if they're coming here permanently. And it's a wonderful thing. And by the way, legal immigrants who are coming here today do have to do that, right? They have formal swearing and ceremonies. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I think it's to be celebrated, and I think most Americans do on that. And third, we can, as you think about that top line, we can certainly allow for others who come here temporarily, such as tourist visas or work visas, and we don't have to expect them to have the same level of agreement with us. That was true of people like the resident hireling or even the Nikar who might have been passing through the land on a very short-term basis. The bottom line of that chart is also difficult to navigate through. Under the Mosaic Code, there is room for having an unequal playing field for immigrants when it comes to participating in the life of government activities. Therefore, it's not a problem for me to say that a foreign-born person cannot become president. It would also not be a problem if a nation, whether ours or anybody else, chose to set up a government that had a number of restrictions on immigrants as to participating in the life of their government. There's no problem with that. A nation could choose to do that, and a nation would have to debate that on the merits for their particular case. But what about us as individuals? This is also very difficult, but here's what I would say in a nutshell. First, for legal immigrants, we ought to be the people who would welcome them and care for them more than anybody else. I just think that's true as Christians. It's hard for me to read the Old Testament and see God's heart for the poor, the widow, the fatherless, and the sojourner, the resident alien, and not see that as a consistent thing, a heart that God has for those people. People who come from their foreign land and immigrate to another are often in a very, very, very vulnerable position. And of all the people on planet Earth that should care for their vulnerabilities, Christians, I just can't see how we can't be at the top of the list that say we would care for such people. Why should we not be the carers for them? I mean, for one thing, what a gospel opportunity for people, I mean, to see the love of Christ demonstrated from us. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to go down to the cities and start volunteering at such places tomorrow, but maybe we should start with the people who move into our neighborhood. And there are a lot more of them that are moving into our neighborhood up here in Chisago County. How could we care for them? And I'm not even talking about the church. I'm talking about you as an individual. Show interest. Immigrants who are here will welcome that. Some of them will initially be actually scared of you, like, what are you trying to get from me? But if you consistently show the love of God to them, what a great opportunity. Now, when it comes to the question of illegal immigrants, here's where I'm at, and not everybody has to be where I'm at, but here's where I'm at. I mean, how do we as individuals think about them? Until the U.S. actually does something to deal with this question, I'm going to treat them personally as if they were here legally. I'm going to be a good neighbor, friend, and advocate for them. This does not mean providing illegal sanctuary for them. If our government began to engage in mass deportation, I might be an advocate against that, depending on the circumstances. But as long as they were not being abused, I do not think as Christians we'd have the right to stand in the way. So there is no such thing as sanctuary churches. You may have heard about that, but that's been a thing for a while. I don't see that as a thing at all. But until our government actually does something about this, I think I need to treat them as fairly as possible. In general, I think we need a whole lot more Boazes in our world who look out for the poor and needy, and less like the kinsman redeemer who wasn't named, who was only looking out for himself. In just a moment, I'll ask for some questions. If you want some further resources, I'll list a couple here. I should have put these up on the board. I didn't. The first is James Hoffmeyer's The Immigration Crisis. It's a book you can pick up on Amazon for a few bucks. I think he does a really nice job. I've developed some ideas from him and others, and he actually has a lot more to say. This is a 150-page book, and so that's way more than I can say in 2 hours' time. A second is Preston Mays, in 2001, I think it was, did a series of lectures at Central Seminary at the McDonald Lectures. Actually, his papers are available online for free. If you're interested in them, I can get you links to them. Also, if you want a little more detail and some technical things, you're welcome to have my paper on the four key terms. Just email me and I'll send you a copy of that. With that, I'm done. Your questions. Yeah.
Actually, I'm just reminded of one born in Tarsus, a Roman citizen, but he was a Jew, circumcised the eighth day, being tied down with leather thongs right before the beating start. How do you beat me? I'm a Roman citizen.
Yeah, so there are clearly advantages to being citizens. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I think probably personally in dealing with illegal immigrants, when looking at like Romans 13 with the idea of let everyone be subject to governing authorities, we might not necessarily need to be like the vigilante taskmasters of like, well, you're an illegal, so I'm not going to have any part with you. But maybe there's a benefit to saying, well, as a Christian, I would advocate, let's, even if they're not enforcing it, advocate for, let's try to do whatever we can to become legal so that conscience-wise before God, we're on the right track, and we have no opportunity for people to say, well, even though it's not really enforced, well, you're not really following the rules. Like, at a workplace, just because somebody doesn't like an OSHA regulation doesn't mean that we just ignore it. We would say, all right, we're trying to get there, though. And considering the potential for mass deportations on the next ticket, maybe we should encourage people to become legal just in case that's an issue that might arise in the future. Because if that does become a problem and people are going to start getting deported, then it would be in their best interest for them to be citizens.
I don't disagree. Yeah, I probably should have said that. Yeah, in fact, that would just be my general encouragement. Pastorally, people who are here illegally, one of the questions I ask is, what are you doing to fix that? That's hard, though. That's not a simple answer. And anybody who knows much about that knows that we're talking a decade process, so, which, as an aside, is also part of the crazy nature of our current system, right? So that makes it hard. So, yeah.
I was just thinking about legal immigrants that act more like traitors, you know, that burn the flag. That's wrong. Just don't.
Yeah, I would certainly condemn that. I would just say, in my experience, my reading, and my talking to people are far more experienced on that. That is such a small minority of immigrants. There really is not a thing. In general, for the better part of a couple hundred years, American immigration has followed a pretty typical pattern. The first generation comes here, and if they don't speak English already, they struggle with English. They just do. And this has happened in just about every place that you go in the United States historically. They struggle with English. They also struggle in that they still have affection for their home culture and the things that they came from. And, you know, I put up those pictures on the board last week about, you know, the Swedish stuff that's still around us in places. I don't have any problem with that. I should just make that clear. But that's a reflection, even now, of 150 plus years later, of the long fingers of culture in someone's life. So the fact that, you know, somebody comes here in a first generation and they might, on the day of their independence or some national holiday, put up their home country's flag, that doesn't bother me at all. We discovered after the girls, we started the process of adopting the girls, that there's actually a large population of Liberians in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, relatively large. And their Independence Day is July 26th, if I remember correctly on that. And they have like Independence Day like we have Independence Day. Actually, their constitution is very similar to ours. It's modeled after that. And there are people in Minneapolis-St. Paul area that will celebrate that day. They'll get together and they'll have a celebration of that day. I don't have a problem with that any more than we remember, you know, that, you know, my people came from this country in the past. So that's pretty normal, especially for first generation. They struggle with language and they struggle with the affection they have for their home country. It's hard. It is hard to leave a home nation. Very, very hard. Why do you think that missionaries in the United States who go to other cultures often get burned out in the field? It's because they miss home. And even if they went there for the right reasons, they miss it. So that's usually what happens to the first generation. The second generation, if they've grown up, you know, maybe they came as very young children or they're born in the United States, they're often bilingual. And they're kind of stuck between two worlds. So they love mom and dad, and they know the lingo of the culture that they came from. But they kind of just really want to start to fit in with where they're at. And by the third generation, unless they marry into a family that speaks their native language, their ability even to speak their home language is almost gone. And by the fourth generation, it's gone completely. They're completely integrated into American life. That is almost always the pattern for the vast majority of immigrants. And it's been that way for a long, long time. So yes, those people exist. And I think as a nation, you know, if you've come here and you've sworn allegiance to the flag, and then the first thing you do is burn it, I think as a nation we have the right to say, well, you can go back. That's fine. I just think that in general, that is such a small number of people in my experience. So in my reading and talking to people who know far more than I do on this. Yeah.
Well, I was going to speak to that. We go to a lot of farmers markets, and a lot of them all have their vegetables and everything. The grandma or the grandparents speak the other language. They don't know it. The parents are bilingual. They're the ones that translate between the grandma and and then the young kids, the teenagers, are completely what we would say is Americanized. They don't know the other language. They just know English perfectly.
And they're hanging out on their iPhones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's just strange. Yeah, those three, yeah. You can just see them all in one application.
Yes, sir.
I think it's important for us to know, just for sake of argument, that we have a fairly high number of our own natural-born citizens who will burn the flag and act in a similar or worse fashion. So that's not something that's native to individuals who are coming into the U.S. on a slightly different...
Especially if you think about people who lived in the 60s, too, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's not new.
No. It's, unfortunately, and again, I have very, very limited knowledge of this subject, so I got to be careful, but to the best of my understanding, the immigration process, if you're going to come to the U.S. legally, or if there have been any hiccups along those lines, it's more than incredibly difficult. It's almost impossible. And so there's individuals who are, they're good people who are struggling with that. And actually, as believers, we probably not only owe it to our fellow believers and neighbors and friends to treat them well, but also even advocate for the fact that our immigration laws stink. I mean, you've spoken to that with the adoption process, and they were so all other individuals who have been stuck in that problem. Like, when the extent of my knowledge when it comes to dealing with legal stuff is it took me 9 months to get my commercial driver's license because somebody missed the date. They put the wrong date on one form, and it hung me up for 9 months. There's no excuse for that, let alone the amount of paperwork you want to cost for the individuals to come to the U.S. legally.
And that's where I think, if we think along those lines, I think that's helpful, is that we need more people like Boaz that really care about that. And that's hard. That takes a lot of work. Not everybody's called to do that, by the way, but it's worth to think about. And there are real, not only practical implications for our society, but there are real gospel opportunities here. Huge ones for thinking about that.
It's not a question, but just as a prayer request, down in southern Texas, the school down there is having issues with people not being able to get their visas to come in for the school, or professors that want to come there. So they're waiting patiently, waiting on the Lord, obviously, but it seems, because this whole thing is, it's complicated, it's not something that's been fixed, and so we just pray for these that need their visas.
Yeah, and there's a number of ministries that are...
Process. I'm sure it's all across the country. You dig in different colleges and universities, different schools, and people are waiting to get their visas approved, their work visas, or whatever, and it's being held up for whatever reasons.
It's a mess. I think everybody in the United States agrees with that. Yeah.
Well, I like that you say, like, individually. And I think looking at immigration and cases individually is a thing, too. Because some people know about my husband, some people probably don't. Very personal. But he came here when he was a child, 16 years old, probably on... you know, recommendations of parents or family or whatever, because his family was very poor. They have a paralyzed brother at home that my husband took care of as a 16-year-old and growing up, and then he didn't plan to fall in love here. Hello, 10 years of marriage now, 3 kids later. But, and we are in the process. Is he a legal resident? Nope. But can he be deported right now? Nope. because we're just sitting in limbo waiting on the immigration system. And that is a long, expensive process of waiting on someone else. So it's like, but in that waiting, we just wait, and he doesn't get any type of anything in the meantime. So it's one of those things where not only do you, like, obviously look at, I like that you say, like, treat each person as if they are legal, because you don't know what individually they have dealt with before getting to where they are. Why are they here? How long have they been here? The average person right now that has been here, that has been married for over 10 years, is 500,000 people. For 23 years or more, the average amount of time is 23 years right now. That's a really long time that are not legal yet. That's a lot of people. So I've been doing a lot of research lately because there's big things happening that some people might know about and might not. But individual cases also are different, you know, because I don't know, like, where does my husband stand in that? He doesn't really. He doesn't really have a place.
That's part of the problem.
Yes.
That's where crossing that bridge gets really hard, because it doesn't fit in directly. And that's where I'm saying, until our country does something about that, you know, that's really hard to do. Thank you for sharing that. Yes, sir.
Ultimately, as believers, we are commanded to love the Lord God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, first and foremost, and then second, to love our neighbor as ourselves, whether that be our American neighbor down the street or our Hmong neighbor across the street or down the road. Yeah, they're among us, really. So that doesn't exactly mean conflating, enabling them in a way that would be unlawful. However, it means we still must love them, because they are still an image bearer. They are still another person. They're still a possible person that we might be able to witness to. And so regardless of their status in our legal society, we are still commanded to love them.
Yep, very true. Yes, sir.
Growing up in Connecticut, I feel like it was such a difference in cultural expectations than out here. I mean, my grandparents spoke Swedish fluently, but refused to teach my dad because they were that close to the immigration process. My uncle was from Egypt, spoke Egyptian fluently, brought his family there. We had Jamaicans, multi-generational families that would come and pick apples because we abutted the apple orchard, and we would go out and listen to them sing and interact with the children. So the idea of treating someone differently because of their ethnic background, my mom fought so hard against that because she grew up in an area where there were some strong racial tensions, to the point where some people weren't going to be allowed to be at her wedding because they were of the wrong skin color, but she ended up having it in a different venue so that they could be there, at least at the reception. And so I worked in places in Connecticut where I was the minority. I was white, stood out like a sore thumb, and I was a female. And so understanding some of the perspective of being under that duress of feeling like you're the minority in the group, I feel like I do in some small aspect understand that between here or Panama or Mexico. But at the same time, working with my own kids and trying to help them realize all of these people are one blood. We are all Adam's descendants, and we need to treat them with love and respect, no matter where they are at in the system. What a better opportunity could we have than to try to reflect Christ in our daily lives as we interact with people. And I do have a burden to make sure that my kids especially know, and if God blesses me with children, grandchildren, that they know that God loves each and every one of them, and they could marry a person from any background, any nationality, and they're cherished. And I think we all need to work on that in our homes, because that's where these young people grow up as the next leaders in their churches or politicians. And if they don't have a heart for people at their core, then they're, after their love for God, obviously, then we're doing something wrong in our homes.
Yes, sir.
Notice, too, that pretty much all of those immigrants, whether legal or illegal, are doing the dirty jobs working in America. They just did their roof on the church. And they were from Venezuela, El Salvador, Mexico. you know. We had our roof done, too, and they were all from Mexico. The power lines were cleaned underneath the trees. Two of the guys were from Cuba with a work card. You know, they're doing the jobs a lot of white boys don't like to do, you know. Manual labor, you know, they're working hard. And they're. I asked them, where are they sending the money? And they're sending it home. But some of them, you know. But it's interesting to know who's doing the hard work around here.
Yeah, and that should remind us too about like that principle of we were once there. That's a pretty also really common pattern on that. All right, I'm going to, for the sake of people who might need to go here tonight, stop here at this point. I hope that has been some help for you to think through. And if it hasn't, just eat cake and eat lots of it and don't talk to me. All right, so we'll pray, ask God's blessing on our evening, and if you're able to stay in a couple of minutes, there'll be some goodies out there you can enjoy. And even if you want to have the goodies, just come down and fellowship for a little bit. And in all seriousness, feel free to ask questions or continue the conversation. Father in heaven, thank you for this evening and for the attentiveness of each individual. Bless us now as we dismiss from this place and be glorified in our lives. Help us to have hearts for people. And God, we do pray for our nation. It is a mess, and we do need leaders who would actually seek to solve this. And that's going to be painful, no matter how it's solved. So, God, would you just give us the right leaders who can do that and fix that mess? In the meantime, just help us to be lovers of the people around us, showing forth the gospel of Christ, not only in action, but also our words, pointing them ultimately to Jesus, because we do long for the day in which members from every tribe and every tongue and every nation will gather, not around the American flag or the Mexican flag or the Liberian flag, but under the banner of the Lord Jesus Christ. We long for that day. Until that day comes, may we be faithful in every area of our life, including this one. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.